Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like
me. I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
How are you supposed to feel that exploitation is the best you can
get? LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
And before we begin, we'll be doing an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners on the land on which we meet, and pay respects to their elders past, present and future. This land was never ceded, and the process of colonization, occupation, incarceration and genocide that began over 2 centuries ago continue to this day. You're listening to Race Card, and I'm Ahmed Yusuf, and today I'm talking to writer, author, poet, Magan Magan, who is just releasing this year and having his launch in a week's time, called From Grains to Gold. Hey, Magan.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, I guess we've talked a lot through the period of time that you started thinking about writing a semblance of a book, a collection of poems, to this point. I guess tell me about getting to this point.
Ooh, it was a big journey, long journey. So I started writing the book in 2015. And when I was writing it, what I was interested in exploring was shame. And in exploring shame, I was writing about that. And then I kind of felt that wasn't resolving my relationship with shame, or how to deal with that. And then after, you know, more thinking and more writing, what I realized was the thing that we carry after we experience shame is grief. And that is the thing that we're carrying. Although we do carry shame, but it's grief that's the actual thing we're carrying. So we experience the shame, and then we carry grief. And so I thought, okay, all right, this is what I should be exploring. It's a heavier subject, meatier subject, and yeah, so...
I guess, what was it like getting to that point? Sort of like realizing what you were trying to grapple with in your writing wasn't really shame, but grief.
Yeah, it was like an aha moment. Because I feel it is the root of what I was trying to... Grief was the root of what it is that I was trying to deal with. And because to the point, I didn't have the understanding of grief that I do now, and that grief comes in different shapes, forms. And it happens a lot more than we actually think. So a lot of time we think grief is just about maybe death or illness, or you know, the big you know, experience in your life, or the big kind of losses. But grief can also be quite personal, you know, quite, for lack of a better word, subjective, but it's there, and we carry it. And grief doesn't, it stays in our body, stays in us until we deal with it, until we confront it. And this is why the framework of the 5 stages of grief is really useful, because we go through the, you know, denial initially, where we don't want to believe that we're going through whatever it is that we're going through. And then hopefully when we pass that stage, we go through the anger, and this anger is filled with a lot of rage, but it's a period of acknowledgement. And then we go through the bargaining, right, where the rage is getting a bit too much, and you know, a bit more, you know, a bit explosive, and it's getting too much, and carrying that rage, it's a lot, and it's draining. And so we begin to you know, negotiate with our pain, negotiate with life, and you know, I'll become smaller, I'll shrink if the pain is less, and I'll do whatever if the pain, you know, goes away. And then in that process of negotiating with life, we begin to maybe start feeling depressed, start feeling hopeless, start feeling like, you know, things are not going to end. This is what our life is. And then once we process that feeling and really get to the root of it, because at that point it's an invitation to really slow time, you know, pace ourselves, really focus on what our problems are, and then we, you know, hopefully get to the stage of acceptance, and that is the stage, you know, filled with knowledge and meaning and purpose, and you kind of begin to understand why things were happening, you know, what was happening. You begin to form connections, and I think that's a really powerful and empowering stage of the whole grief process. Yeah, and then we begin to, you know, find meaning, and then we can overcome, and you know, we begin to have like a richer inner experience, a richer, deeper understanding of our life and why we're here and what our purpose is, and I think that's the goal for me anyway, like to get to that point every time there's grief. And you know, whether it's you're dealing with friends or the loss of a friend in terms of even that might have died, or you know, loss of a relationship, whatever it is, or you know, you've had a falling out with a friend, or you know, trying to grapple with something your mother or maybe father has said to you many years ago, and that's being with you, or whether it's your body image issue, whatever it is, you know, facing it and looking into it gives us meaning, gives us a something that we didn't particularly maybe realize or understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like it sounds like writing the book, you went through all these, because the chapters go through those five stages that you just talk about, but writing the book, how was it going through that process of sort of like encompassing the spaces of grief?
It was empowering, cathartic. You know, it gave me the opportunity to delve into parts of myself that I didn't perhaps or think about. I just evolve in general. I feel like this whole process for me has been a process of evolving and connecting with myself, and that's something powerful. But in obviously in connecting with yourself and evolving, you have to go through pain. You know, it's the same as like, you know, going to the gym, you know, working out. There's you have to put your body through physical pain in order to get the goals that you want to achieve. It's kind of the same thing with life and problems and evolving, or moving past certain experiences, moving past certain state of mind, like perceptions about yourself or struggles. You know, you got to go through that pain in order to move past it and evolve, and you know, because then you get the opportunity to give back. And yeah, so it was really empowering for me, and really useful and hard as well, because I had to think about a lot about my life and where I had been, where I am, where I want to go, the space between each of those, space between who I am and who I want to be, space between who I was and who I am, and reconciling with that, and then reconciling with who I want to be and how I'm not there yet, and those kinds of feelings.
Well, who've been your inspirations in writing this book? Some of the writers or people that, I guess, clarified things for you, or like gave you a way to find language to put this work together?
Yeah, one big person, major influence on me is David White. He's a Irish, I love David White and his writing, but he's a Irish philosopher and poet, and he writes about life and writes about the stages of life, and has a powerful ability to articulate the different stages of a human being goes through in a really eloquent and relatable way. And so he often talks about talks about, you know, that quite often people don't want to have the conversations that they really need to be having with themselves. And he goes through the power of having that conversation you don't want to have with yourself, and the benefits to it, and what it does for us as human beings, you know, our life, and how that is so intertwined with evolving. You know, talks about vulnerability, talks about grief. You know, he in an interview once he said that no one can survive a real conversation. And when I thought about that, I couldn't help but think that really it's about your identity. So if your past self is having a conversation with your future self, there's going to be friction there, because the future self knows certain things, has gone through certain things that the present self hasn't gone through yet. And in that transformation from the present self to the future self, there's a dying almost of the present self. So in order to evolve, you almost have to die. And in the conversations, that's the kind of process that occurs in real conversations. You have to let go of your ego. You have to let go of the fantasies you've built in your head. And you have to let go of who you thought you were to become who you want to become. And no one survives those. But in saying that, you are rebirthed into something, into someone more powerful and more authentic in who you are, and, you know, knowing yourself more. And the thing about, like, the whole grief process is, you know, you begin to have clarity. And I think there's nothing more powerful than having clarity in your own life with who you are, you know, what you are, your values. You know, there's a cliche that everyone who's gone through struggle has known, or something really terrible, right? You know, before that, you're surrounded by a billion people, you have all these friends and blah, blah, and then you go through something so horrendous and isolating, and you realize who's really there. And quite often, it's just maybe one person, two people, or no one, and you realize, what was my life about? And you get that clarity of, oh, these people weren't my people. You know, maybe that person was. And that's, you know, I feel like that's what I want to aim for in terms of clarity of, you know, being in tune with reality. And, yeah. So David White, for sure, is, yeah, David White. Mary Oliver, again, her poem Wild Geese is just...
it's a beautiful poem.
It's a beautiful poem. And as a writer and as a poet, like, that poem, I go back to all the time, because it, for me, that poem is about writing. And she says, you don't have to be good. You don't have to be good. You just got to write. You just got to do it. And, you know, you'll get there. And it's just a powerful poem. And her poem, The Journey, and that poem Journey really illustrates the journey of life and what happens, you know, meeting bad people, getting bad advice, you know, what that does for you. And, you know, rebirthing yourself and your fantasy of yourself dying, and, you know, coming on that journey and reaching the point of acceptance. It's really that poem is basically my whole book. Yeah.
I want to start with a quote that you begin the book with.
Yes.
It's by Maher Kher.
Yeah.
Could you read it for me?
Yes, sure. It is difficult to be naked whilst the others are watching you.
Why did you decide on that line?
Because so much of what we do when we're in pain is we want to hide our pain. We want to become smaller, shrink, hide in the back so no one can see us, so no one can see our pain, so no one can see our struggles. And we build walls up and, you know, so that we can not be seen. And so I thought that this quote really illustrated that very, in a very vulnerable way, because you feel naked when you're in pain, when you're suffering, and
Especially when you don't want other people to see you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you just feel, you know, when you're sensitive, when you're in a really highly sense emotionally, you know, your emotions are high and you feel like, you know, anything can break you. You feel naked. You also feel like, you know, who can see this? And so I just thought that would be, that's a really beautiful quote, a line to start with.
The first chapter is denial, and yes, you start the chapter by saying, my father hits me, but he loves me. Why?
So in the, with denial, I think it's a very tough place to be. We've all been there, and it always seems like the easier thing to do is if we pretend it's not happening, if we pretend that person didn't say that to me, or that person didn't do that to me, or, you know, whatever didn't happen to me, if I just pretend it'll go away. And that line really is about denial, but it's also about the way we see love, how we define love. You know, my father hates me, but he loves me. You know, is that really love? If your father hits you, is that really love?
I guess, what do you feel when you read that?
Just the desperation in that person that's saying that. The desperation in, but he loves me. That, you know, it's almost like it's intoxicating. Like, and then it's like, you know, it's almost like a tornado, and you get getting, it's like the person's dizzy. But they're trying to it's not a word, but undizzy themselves, you know. They're trying to
stop.
Yeah. Yeah, trying to pause everything, you know. Trying to make it okay, make it make sense, make it, you know. So yeah, that's why I
was wondering if you could read the poem Denial.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Actually, can I read Smoke and Mirrors instead?
Yeah, you can read Smoke and Mirrors.
Smoke and Mirrors. When Ella's mother throws her out, Ella says, it is my choice. When they leave, Ella says, I let go. When Ella's lover says, I don't love you anymore, she says, it is okay. When they say no, when they say not you, you're different from the rest, she tells herself they didn't mean to say that. The mechanic hikes the price for servicing. She says, I need the extra service. When she feels you looking at her face turning into a muddy river and her skin filling up with little holes of heat and sweat, she says, I wish you'd turn around. You know, we all know an Ella. We, at some point, we all were an Ella. You know, denying absolutely everything about our life. And it's in all of us. She's in all of us. But it's a very devastating place to be. You know, Ella's a very, very devastated person, a very devastating person as well, because, you know, when we don't deal with our problems, when we don't face our issues, it impacts everyone else around us, whether we want to or not, whether we intend to or not. And it just keeps on going. And it's a
vicious circle.
Yeah, it's a very vicious circle. And in that vicious circle, there comes a point where the Ella in us can't deny what is happening, you know, which force, and that's life, forces us to look at it. And at that particular point, it's generally when we have been slammed to the floor, slammed to the ground. Maybe we've lost our house, we've, our lovers left us, our, you know, we've lost our job, and we're falling out with all our friends, and you know, maybe we've taken up drugs and alcohol and whatever to compensate for, you know, to ease our pain. But then we have at that particular point, we are forced to make a decision, a choice. Do we stay in this place of darkness and loss and sorrow and grief, or do we get up and try and, you know, fight try and make things right for ourselves first and foremost. And in that, at the end, which says, I wish I'd turn around. You know, unfortunately, some people make the commitment to stay in that position, to stay in the denial, to stay in that place. And reason number one why we don't want to be in that place is because it makes us mean. It can make us mean and bitter. The Ella in us, that person in us who's so desperate to be in denial, to not acknowledge, can change us. And no one is above change that is negative and positive. We have it in us. We can transform our lives and be powerful human beings with goodness. We can also go the other way as well. And no one is immune. No one, without the work, no one is immune from that.
I just want to highlight a line you write.
Sure.
I enjoy bondage, you said one afternoon. Is that because you'd at least come from being whipped rather than being choked in class?
Yeah. In that, passage, I'm trying to highlight or express the choices we have, I enjoy bondage, you said. This is the person is going through the struggle. And in that, they're expressing a choice they have, something that, that they enjoy it, something that they are expressing themselves, something that they want. But then the narrator is, or the person talking to that person is asking, is that because you'd at least come from being whipped rather than being choked in class? Then there's that picture of what that person's life is like. So in that terrible circumstance, that person who's experiencing that is within that finding a choice for themselves. So I'm in this disgusting, terrible situation.
Like Ella.
Yes, exactly. And this person somehow found choice within that limiting personal circumstance.
Finding a space.
Exactly. And in that, I'm trying to highlight our inner personal power within ourselves. And that is choice. Even those person's choices are very limited. They've somehow figured out, a way. If I'm going to suffer pain, by being choked in class, but in that, if I'm going to experience pain, then let me experience a pain that I'm going to enjoy, or a pain that is going to give me something at least. That's bondage. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I feel like it's enough time to move to anger.
Yes.
You start the chapter with, they should have taught you the difference between a caring body and a curious one. What does that mean to you?
That to me is talking to a person who's either people around them, or the people that have authority over them, whether it was their parents, teachers, whoever, uncles, aunts, grandparents, who were never taught the difference between someone who's caring, who cares about them, and in care I mean someone who sees them for who they are, not for who they want them to be, and a curious one, because a lot of people like to just collect information about you, just take from you. That may not be a physical thing, but it might be information about you, and for me, learning the difference between a caring body and a curious one is very important for us to maintain a healthy sense of self, boundary, and emotions. And you can't do that unless you begin to build boundaries. And with boundaries, almost like you kind of use anger in a way that's building about like building a boundary. It's all about acknowledgement, because when you're angry, it's a form of acknowledging something. Something's happened, you're acknowledging it. So that's why I thought that'd be good to start with.
Full circle.
Sure.
Could you just read the poem?
Yeah, sure. Full circle. This city was dense with apathy the night Zach died. But when you saw your son arch his lower back and he looked happy in heels, you grabbed his hand and hauled his body across the city all the way to Zach's graveyard. You pushed your son to face Zach's stone. You dropped your knees to the ground and then to your face, rubbing it against Zach's grave, remembering the disgust on your face with the way Zach's hips swayed. You hollered, "My heart is open, take it, do what you want to do, please." The wind began to growl, and the leaves on the floor submitted to the air and fled, leaving room to see what was engraved on Zach's tombstone. "I am the fading part of the moon."
Tell me about that poem.
So this poem is about apathy. And apathy is a theme that I'm interested in exploring, and it comes, you know, it's a part of this collection, but yeah, it's about apathy, and it's about, you know, a person inflicting pain on someone else, and then they end up experiencing that exact same pain, so it goes full circle, and then they realize their vulnerability to apathy, and, you know, apathy impacts every single human being. You know, some people believe it doesn't impact them, but it does, and it will.
Why do you think they think that?
I think there's arrogance, there's not enough foresight, humility, not enough, it's a person not really looking at their own weaknesses as a person, and we're all vulnerable, you know. We're all going to die. We're all dying in a sense. So someone that's not aware of those, has not thought about those things and not cared enough to think about those things, and is just more interested in what they want, you know.
I guess a theme that goes throughout the book, I feel, is parenthood.
Yeah.
The experiencing of a child experiencing parenthood, the parents in I was wondering, there are two more poems that I want to talk about in this chapter.
Yeah.
The first one is "You Are Her Mother."
Okay.
Could you read that for me?
Sure. "You are her mother, and she is your daughter. You relate scriptures to her, and she writes strange love poems to you. The balls of her feet reek of regret and your name. Her mouth stretches open. The words I'm moving out leave her mouth the way a soul leaves the body of a person being choked to death. You are her mother. You jump into her suitcase, hug your body and scream, 'Don't leave.' She bargains with you as though you are her child refusing to eat. The sound of your voice lathers her mind. You are the foundations of her home, but you know that, don't you?"
What are you trying to say in this poem?
I'm trying to express toxic parent child relationships.
Like the line you say, "You are her mother, you jump into her suitcase, hug your body and scream, 'Don't leave.'" That really jumps out to me.
Yeah. Trying to create an image of it's almost like in that particular scenario, the roles are reversed. It's like the mother is a child and the daughter is a mother. And that relates, that goes back to someone, the mother's obviously someone who hasn't dealt with her own problems and is projecting and not facing her own grief and her own struggles in life, and has brought that to her daughter. And in this, there's this really strange relationship in a strange way. The mother in this poem, this is the mother when she wants to, and is a child figure when she wants to. And I'm trying to, in that, express the ways, the many ways, or the commitment some people take in order to control an individual, whether it's your mother, father, friend, and they often go between, it often is overt and covert, depending on when it's beneficial. And yeah, so in that poem, I'm trying to express that, and that the person that's causing trouble already knows the hold that they have over the person. So whilst the victim is a lot of the time trying to figure out if the abuser or whoever knows what they're doing, do they know what they're doing? Do they, like, are they aware of this? And I'm trying to highlight that most often than not, the person causing trouble knows what they're doing.
It sounds, for me, it's similar to Full Circle, in the sense of how Zach, in this instance, in that instance, is being controlled in how they can use their body.
Right.
And in this instance, the character in You Are Her Mother is being controlled in her agency.
Right.
And sort of where she can go.
Right.
And that's at the whims of her mother.
Right.
Why do you feel that you needed to express that?
I don't think there's enough conversation about the way control is killing many people, is destroying the self-esteem, the self-worth, identity of so many people. It's an important topic, and it manifests in so many ways. It happens all the time, and there isn't a conversation about that. And if there is, it's quite superficial, and people have their own agendas for that kind of conversation, and it often triggers it's an intense conversation. It triggers people's own insecurities. Maybe I haven't defined what control really means. So yeah, it's just a conversation that I would like to have, be part of, to see happening,
because otherwise you become the fading part of the moon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So when I left in 1999.
Sure. What page is that
on? It's on page 31. But I just wanted to talk about this passage.
Sure.
My body is my bag. I put the loneliness in it. My heart where it fits. And where does the longing lay? In my feet, tightly. So why does the longing lay in this character's feet?
Because I wanted to play on the idea of, like, walking, you know, you're walking, but also longing is almost like you're searching for something. So this person's searching, or I want to play on longing, the idea of longing. I always look at it as a journey. The person is looking for something, longing, like you're looking at something from a distance, something that you want, and you can only get there if you move. And so therefore I thought, you know, putting it in the feet, because the feet can, person can walk towards it. You know, what it is that they want. But yeah, our body is something that carries all of our experiences. You know, it is like kind of like a bag. We put all our memories, all our experiences, you know, our heartaches, our loneliness, our inner secrets, our thoughts and feelings. It's all in there. And, you know, at some point it gets a bit too heavy. Gets a bit too much, and that's where we have our crises and breakdowns, and it's too much.
There's another part that I'm interested in is that you say, Father, say whatever it is you want to say, but I wanted this home to be a sweet voice, a warm hug, a loving eye. Home was like a thorn, leaving cuts on my arms.
Yeah, this is a person that's a child taking back their power. You know, taking back what's theirs. Expressing to their father what they wish this home was. And it isn't that. That I am with, I want to know freedom like I know solitude. It's in this house, being by yourself this whole time. Not free to be who you are, not free to feel what you're feeling, to say your thoughts. So this person's really reclaiming their life and taking it and leaving the house. So it's almost like they're leaving their home to go to their home. And home, for me anyway, is within me. I've struggled with belonging my entire life, and I've recently felt belonging, and it hasn't been in another person. It hasn't been in a specific physical place, but it's been within me. And what that really means for me when I think of belonging is being okay with who you are, your inner thoughts, you having just inner peace, having just thinking about your life, and you're like, I don't have drama. Like, I don't have drama. But those are, you know, it's a journey, and it's about the choices you want to make and really staying committed to that journey of like self-preservation. And because the world would say what you're doing is wrong. People will tell you what you're doing is wrong. You know, you're too angry, you're too toxic, you're too harsh, you cut people out too easily, or you do this too easily, you know, chill out. But you know, we need to stay as committed to our journey towards healing and journey towards freedom and reclaiming our life and story in the same way that the world or other people are committed to breaking us down.
Bargaining. You start the chapter with, all those years we spent staring at her lips, violently waiting for the weight of her stubborn, pretty soul to murmur what could free her. Your mother will not apologize, though. She is your mother.
Yeah, this is a call to not waiting for someone's approval or someone's acknowledgement of what they may have done to you, may have said, what may have happened to you. It's calling. Sometimes people won't give it to you. The person that's hurt you won't give you the thing that you're wanting, acknowledgement, apology, whatever it is. And so we need to, within ourselves, give that to ourselves. And that's, again, that's taking power back to ourselves and saying, oh, I can give that. I will give that to myself, you know, and moving past it. So,
could you read Mother?
Sure. Mother, there was something about how desperate you were, how you smelt of sorrow dipped in vinegar. You were sweltering in your loneliness. After some time, you turned into an onion. When they cut, your bloodied legs sting the world. Since when has anything forbidden stopped you from wanting? Your body ached in two parts, one for your mother, the other memories carried from the empty, dry land of Dilla. On the news this morning, I heard your name, Somalia, hoisted onto your small shoulder as if it were a heavy gun.
When you say on the news this morning, I heard your name, Somalia, hoisted on your shoulder as if it were a heavy gun, what are you trying to say?
Yeah, so with this poem, I used mother and Somalia as both meanings. As you know, you could take this poem to mean it's about Somalia, our motherland, or our mothers. So in that last stanza, I am reflecting on the burden that Somalis have when it comes to how the rest of the world views Somalia versus what it's like to be Somali, what your experience is as a Somali, as a human being, but as a Somali person living in the West. Because the West sees Somalia as war, as troubled. And we do have a history of war, and, you know, parts of Somalia, there are issues that are quite visible. But it's the grappling with the stereotypes or the meaning behind Somalia's a war-torn country.
The lack of nuance behind it.
Yes, because a person can say Somalia is a war-torn country or was a war-torn country and mean that it went through civil war. Or they could mean it as Somalia is a less than, you're less than. The war is representative of who you are. And so you come to this, we came to this country, I mean, a lot of us did, some of us were born here, but our parents came here, fleeing war. And then the war almost hasn't stopped, you know. And so Somalia's always represented as a gun. So you're carrying Somalia.
An AK-47.
Yeah, exactly. So you're carrying Somalia, you're carrying a gun, and then you're carrying the... what it means for your country to go through civil war, what it means for your parents to flee civil war, what it means for what that's done for your parents and for you. But then you're also carrying what the West sees of you, which is the gun. They see the war, they see the...
They don't see you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So it's that struggle.
Depression. You start the chapter with your brain is slowly being covered with a cold blanket.
That's how to me depression feels like. It's like that. It's like a I've struggled with depression, and that's how it's felt for me when I feel depressed. Like it's like something's covering my head.
It's funny. It's funny you say that because I was recently watching a TV show called Big Mouth.
Okay.
It's about it's an animated series about young people, young preteen teens.
Yeah.
Going through adolescence.
Yeah. Right.
And one character is grappling with issues in their family life, and they are in a space where they've been taken to this depression room in this mythical place because they've got a hormone monster who takes them through adolescence.
Yeah, right.
And so they've been given a new hormone monster who works in depression.
Yeah.
And what happens to her is that she's put in a room where the door disappears, and she's put in a bed and a blanket is over her head. When I read that, the representation was very interesting.
Yeah, right. Wow.
I'd like you to read Fatherhood.
Sure. Fatherhood. Your father slammed you to the ground. Then he held you up and told you how brave you were. What do you do with that kind of love? Do you wear it like a fur coat? Children like us die so other people can live. That's what you said to Susan on your cigarette break near the dumpsters out the back. Where do you keep your childhood? Is it in your bag? Do you wait until the night gives you permission to take it out? Your childhood jumps out like a frog when you sigh. And then we accuse you of being ashamed, of being bloated with childhood noise. During your last days, you tell strangers on the street you will stand next to the sun and you promise to win. You die of heat stroke when you realize your father was capable of love. And mother said the morning sun was a presence in your room that day. You remind me of him, she continues, huffing. You always forget to listen. On a drunken night, your father jumps up and down and swears to Allah that all you have to do to get a woman to fall in love with you is wear her like rubber boots in the rain. He stumbles across to the kitchen. He pulls out a bottle of wine, holds it up against the light and says, I made your mother think I needed her protection, the way rubber boots protect your feet from getting wet.
The line, you remind me of him, she continues, huffing, you always forget to listen. What does that mean to you?
To me, it's like, how does someone forget to listen? Is that intentional? Is it not? And I'm trying to, in that line, trying to kind of tease out the voicelessness in the son. You know, she's just speaking at him. She's telling him what he's doing and he says nothing. There's nothing else in that.
Because he doesn't want to be.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's why I took the always forget to listen.
Yeah.
It sounds to me that he is purposely not listening to this line that his mother is telling him.
Yeah, yeah.
Why? Why was it important to put that line there?
Perspective. The person that died of a heat stroke, right, reminds her of her son, and he's someone that struggled throughout his life. And when someone says listen, they're giving you an order. They're telling you to do something. And the listen is really almost like relative. Maybe he is listening, but he's not doing what you want him to do.
Maybe he's listening, but he's not hearing.
That also. Because when it comes to the powerless and the powerful, the powerless hear what the powerful are saying. Or when you're protesting, you hear what they're saying, you just object to what they're saying. You know, and the powerful can create a narrative of you're not listening. And really when you dig down, that's about power. And who is really listening in that scenario?
The last chapter is acceptance. A cool breeze greets you here. Let your skin peel. Your pain has meaning here. No one can ever take that from you. You start the chapter that way. Why?
Because the acceptance stage is really powerful. It's when, for example, you know, say a person's being bullied for the way they look, and then they get to a place where they look at the person and the person's saying the things that making fun of the way that they look, and they're just like, I don't give a fuck. It's reclaiming your power. And once you have an inner understanding of yourself and who you are and what you've gone through, and you honor what you've gone through, then no one can take that from you. Your experience is yours. No one can take that from you.
Could you read the poem From Grains to Gold?
Sure. From Grains to Gold. You must leave some things behind, the moon says to me. So I drag a kitchen knife starting from my chest down to my belly button. Then I start to pull my intestines out as though I am pulling a sink plug out of a sink. Let your childhood out. The rigid trace your father left on your mother's jaded neck, let them drain, the moon says to me. I watch them twirl like the hips of a person hula hooping, and just like that, I can no longer see them.
I want to talk about that last stanza, and just like that, I can no longer see them. Is that the experience of letting go?
Yeah, it is. It is of accepting, of that thing not holding you back, not taking a hold over you. You know, you can now walk not with your head down, but with your head up. Because you have meaning, you've gone through things, you understand certain things. It's almost like it's a badge of honor. You know, these are my experiences, I honor them. I also let go of what it did to me.
It's like Ella finally leaving.
Exactly, exactly.
The last poem that I just want to talk about is The Old Panic.
Sure.
And you end it with, whoever it is, whatever it is, if they dizzy you, they do not belong to you.
Yeah.
And I just want you to talk to me about that stanza.
Yeah, what I'm talking to the person who's around people who aren't good for them. Toxic people or toxic workplace, whatever it is. And you know that if you feel like the people around you don't have your best interest at heart, you need to let them go. They're not yours. And if that means letting go of every single person in your life so you can rebuild your life and find people that you can, that belong to you and you belong to them. And that's the necessary process. But it's important. And they're not yours. So if you feel like there's jealousy or there's hatred or there's envy or they're just always interested in crushing you or you can't be yourself around them or you make excuses or you say, oh, I mean, they're okay in this scenario, but in that scenario, they're not okay. So I just avoid them in that scenario, but I'll do this when, you know, with them. And they're just social friends. You know, I won't go anywhere else with them, but I just party with them more. They don't belong to you. And it's important we listen to ourselves and listen to our body, because our body is telling us who is and who isn't good for us. You know, our intuition, our body is more truthful than speech, because we can convince ourselves otherwise, but our body, that gut feeling, that feeling that stays with you is true, and we need to listen to that. I'm urging people to listen to that.
It's like the poem from Grains to Gold is talking about letting go.
Yeah.
And this Old Panic ends with now the process of cutting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it ends. Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you, Ahmed. I love the conversation.
It's been really lovely.
It has.
Before we go, I just want to get some details about where people can find your book.
Yes, sure. So people can find my book at my website. It's www.muggan.com. So my name is spelled as M-A-G-A-N, M-A-G-A-N. So www.muggan.com.
And buy his book.
Yes.
It's a beautiful, beautiful poem. And I just want to read out an inscription at the back by Maxime Benema-Clark, who says, Muggan's poetry, sophisticated and carefully sculpted, makes the characters in From Grains to Gold leap off the page in all their fever and frustration and into our hearts. This book is an ambitious and confident debut from a writer we will surely see more of. And if you don't believe me, believe one of Australia's best authors. Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.